Welcome back, everybody. We are talking with Ricardo Duchesne, author of The Uniqueness of Western Civilization, and behind the website eurocanadian.ca, together with Jason Erb, a previous guest, and a couple of other contributors, as Ricardo mentioned, as well. Now, let's talk a little bit more about the left-center-right political spectrum that we've seen basically arisen practically all over the Western world recently, and they all seem to be very much in favor and supportive of immigration. They are all supporting the same policies. There are not a lot of political parties that actually represented an oppositional stance to this. Although, of course, in Europe now, Ricardo, finally, we've actually seen a rise of parties that actually are anti-European Union. They are against the open border, you know, mass immigration policies. You have, of course, Front National in France. We have the Swedish Democrats in Sweden, Jobbik in Hungary. There are a couple of parties in Denmark and other, not Germany, but there's another country. Maybe it was Switzerland. I forget right now. But there might have individually some issues that could be debated or whatnot. But I think that that's a positive trend, Ricardo, that actually shows that there's awareness coming to this right now, where people have kind of a reinvigoration of you know, nationalism once again. What would you say about this kind of rise in some kind of political opposition as a viable option to what we've seen in the last few years, with this kind of merger of you know, socialism and capitalism, of this left center right political spectrum? Is there any way out of that and to break that pattern that we've seen for such a long time?
Not in Canada. I mean, in Canada, the situation is really different. We don't have any signs of any political movement challenging the current pro-immigration system. But I'm aware that in Europe, there are many parties. And I do have an article in the blog with the title, The Moderateness of the Far Right and the Extremism of Immigration. And one of the things that I notice as I look at the policy platform of various European parties in Europe is that those parties that are called extremists by the mainstream media happen to be the ones that have challenged the immigration policies and that want to restrict immigration. It doesn't matter what their other policies are. Many of them are libertarian. Some of them are even socialistic in some respects. They want, like, the National Front in France. They want a strong government presence in the economy. And then others are environmentalists and so on. It doesn't matter. The moment they challenge the key component, pillar of the system, which is open borders and mass immigration, they will call extremists by everyone. It's amazing. So, I'm aware, not that much, but I'm aware of these political parties in Europe and that they are growing numbers of people that are in disagreement and really can see the failure of immigration in England and France. But we have nothing like that in England, and I mean in Canada.
Yeah.
And it goes back to that point that the Canadian model is being used as the successful model, in part for that reason.
Yeah, definitely good points there. I think that I've been very surprised. I mean, we on this website come from an alternative perspective, and we've been in opposition to the elite and what the globalists have been doing from the start, pretty much, and I've been. It's been very interesting to see that how many people are chiming in with the mainstream media actually on this particular point that you just mentioned. Not everyone, though, of course, absolutely not. There's a lot of people seeing through this finally now, and they're realizing that this is another component towards, you know, globalism and the world government and all the other things that we've seen. And the nations have, of course, now stands in the way of that. That's why they're trying to eradicate it. But do you see that there's any hope, if we'll talk at, you know, the United States and Canada specifically, then any chance that there's going to be something similar reawakened there, or again, is the programming that this is a nation of immigrants so strong that it's kind of has a permanent stronghold right now, Ricardo?
I don't see right now in Canada any signs that there is a movement of considerable size that is challenging and is going to challenge this model of multiculturalism. The Conservative Party in Canada is very much for immigration. When the former Minister of Immigration and Multiculturalism, Jason Kenney, was in power, I mean, he has another position now. It's kind of close to the position he used to have before on immigration. But when he was the Minister of Immigration, he introduced a number of policies that were viewed by critics of immigration as really good policies. He finally, there is someone challenging the system, wants to make it better. But in reality, the number of immigrants, if anything, increased during his tenure. And recently was interesting, and I was going to write an article about that. There was a socialistic guy who criticized him on the workers permit program. This is a program where you allow temporary workers to come into Canada and do some kind of work, and corporations like that, because they hire them temporarily and then can dismiss them, and the government doesn't have to give them citizenship at least right away, and so on. So when somebody challenged the minister for this workers program, he went on in a kind of hysterical way through a number of tweets, which I have here in bookmark, saying how his government is so pro-immigration, so pro-multiculturalism, we brought more immigrants than anybody, we did this, we did that. He's really competing, almost as if to say, I'm more of a cultural Marxist than any of you socialists have been. So you really see there how the conservatives in Canada are very much into this. I mean, the Sun News, this is something I make reference to in a recent article where I use the title. Let me see here, just to get the exact title, is the left, center, right political spectrum of immigration, and then I say equals cultural Marxism.
Yeah.
So basically, the argument I made there is that all of these different sides, left, center, right, as they exist now in many Western societies, are in agreement on what I think is a fundamental question of our times. And so that's why I call them cultural Marxists. So I don't see, at least in Canada, any movement away from that kind of political spectrum.
Yeah. Well, that's very unfortunate, of course, but hopefully there is a cultural, you know, debate that can start from the bottom up that I think it's so necessary. I think all over the Western world, but I see this very much as well as obviously as economic policy. This is helping to, you know, dump the wages further. It's all about the numbers, the money. But this is, I think, this is evidence of the just empty materialism that has come with the corporate world, and the fact that there is no allegiance at all anymore to, you know, the folk identity, the identity of the people, or even, you know, ethnicity, and it's such an openness that we lead to a disillusionment and a complete dissolvement of the items and of the things that actually have kept us together, Ricardo, for thousands of years, as far as we know it. When you care for your people, and this is causing, I've seen this in Swedish society as well, this is causing a kind of a hyper individualization. People are so isolated to a certain extent, and they're losing this greater you know, connection to the people. It doesn't feel like a common cause anymore. It doesn't feel like a brother or a sisterhood, and all these bonds are severed. And I think that's very, very efficient if we look at this kind of political strategy, not only of controlling people, but getting them basically not to be able to work together and creating these isolated units where they're basically just part of the statistics and the number charts. And I'm really worried about that type of development where there's no you know, spirituality part of it. There's no ethnicity part of it. There's no cohesive cooperation at all. What do you see about this, Ricardo?
Well, when I was on the left, one of the reasons that drew me to the left was that I believe they had a stronger sense of community, of valuing something other than money and consumerism, which I associated with the right. And there is truth to that. I mean, if you look at some of the things Karl Marx said about capitalism, you can relate to them if you are an old conservative, in the sense that he said that capitalism, global markets, and so on will dilute and break up all communities, values, and beliefs that people had. And the predominant values are going to be those that are akin to a type of consumerism and accumulation that is required by capitalism. So you see this among many leftists, this concern with the community, concern with the way capitalism breaks boundaries, and it just doesn't respect people's other concerns. But the problem is that the kind of communitarianism that has been advocated and articulated by leftists, including Charles Taylor and many others, is a form of communitarianism that comes from the above, that is sought through by intellectuals, and it's really an idea, socialistic idea, that they wish to impose to counter some of the more deleterious effects of capitalist individualism. It is not a communitarianism that really comes from the ground up, that has been existing through many centuries, and it's associated with strong ethnic religious roots. They dismiss that kind of communitarianism, including Karl Marx. He brushed them off as, he said, good riddance for that old type of community. There was going to be a new socialism imposed from the top. So one has to reject that communitarianism coming from the left. Then the next question is, can we simply try and resurrect the old communities? And I think that is obviously impossible. In that sense, I do think that modernity, modernization, economic development, technological change is here to stay, and we have to come to terms with it. One of the persons that I think is useful to read in this regard is Oswald Spengler, because Oswald Spengler, I'm not fully acquainted with his thinking on this issue, but from what I have read, I get a sense in which he said that we're just going to have to embrace this competition for innovation, science, and technology, because that is the only way you're going to be able to survive as a people and as a nation in the world, or Western civilization is going to be able to survive. So there are things that one could borrow and see in Japan and South Korea. They're very high-tech societies. Clearly, they don't have open borders. They have, you know, assimilated many aspects of modern, fluid societies, but they're still kept with their ethnic integrity, because that's key. Even if you give up or see many aspects of your culture being diluted, as long as you have that ethnic core still there, you can make of that something in the future if things look weak in the present. But there are other forces at play as well, and this is something that I'm not going to say much about it right now, but speaking of Spengler, we may be witnessing is not simply or only the takeover of a cultural Marxist ideology, but it's a civilizational cycle. We have enjoyed so much prosperity and affluence that we have all our guards down.
Yes.
We have created people with a psychological disposition in which they don't understand the struggle for survival. They don't understand the us versus them. They think that if there are people that are very different from them walking in their midst, that's okay. These people are enriching them. They can see that these people are potential enemies and will be so in more difficult circumstances. So the very success, the very affluence that we're experiencing in our time, and we have been experiencing for many decades, despite the ups and downs, is what is in a sense, bringing a downfall. I mean, Rome experienced this. If you look at Rome, I was just reading the book by Rostosev, which is a classic book that was written in 1929 about Rome. And when you look at what he says about Roman values in the 3rd, 4th, 2nd centuries BC, as Rome is rising, these were values that were really very strong oriented, a lot of emphasis on discipline, on working in farms. The Roman soldiers, the soldiers who made up the Roman army, were also farm people. They work on the farm during the season in which the farms had to be taken care of, and then when they were called upon to defend and advance Roman interests, they did so as soldiers, and they equipped themselves, and they also were citizens and could participate in politics. And they had many virtues that the Romans talk about, and Cato is someone who symbolizes some of these virtues of avoiding effeminacy, easy lifestyle, but concentrating on your farm, your family, procreating children. Women perform their traditional role, men perform their roles. So these kinds of values, when you look at the last century BC into the first century AD of Roman history, you see them disappearing. And many conservative Romans saw this and understood this, and were blaming the decline of morals that one sees through the civil wars, and that one sees in the first AD and second AD and so on. We're blaming it on this decline of the old Roman virtues. Marriages were breaking apart. Romans were becoming infertile. They were not even having children. The population was declining. Migrants were coming in into Rome. And so it was a long, prolonged decline. And eventually, Rome was a degenerate, corrupt society that had assimilated many Asiatic values, had become a despotic nation. And fortunately, people, many historians see it as a bad thing, but I think it was a good thing. These vibrant, energetic Germans came in and sort of brought them down, and then gradually and slowly created their own dynamic nations and cultures through the whole medieval era. We don't have that now. That is, we don't have any barbarians to replace us. They're going to be fresh and rejuvenate us. So I don't know what's going to happen. And the thing is that with these immigration policies, there may be a permanent dissolution from which there is no possible revival in the future. I mean, we may come out of the downward civilizational cycle as civilizations have done. I mean, China has gone up and down, but when they come up, they're still ethnically cohesive and homogeneous, and that gives them a sense of more purpose and directness than we will be lacking.
Well, exactly. This is a very interesting point. I think the similarity here is of course, very interesting with the rise and fall cycle of various civilization, but especially Rome. I think there is a weakness, though, of sorts that have, or of sorts, it is a weakness, a decadence and all these other things that have gotten into Western civilization. And I mean, think about it, no other people in the history of the world, as far as I'm concerned, as far I know, have handed over their lands and their assets, if you will, that their ancestors have worked for generations. And okay, it's not as clear cut as that, of course. And I'm not talking about issues of helping others, a good tendency within the West and foreign aid and all that. I'm not talking about that. What we're seeing is something quite differently. It's almost like it is a disease from within that has affected our psychology in that regard. And if there is a decline of the West that Spengler talked about and all that, I think we're seeing that right now. I think that this is a cycle that is not going to be as prolonged as they were in the past. I think, Ricardo, that we're in a very different time now as well. These cycles are much quicker, both due to communication and transportation and technology also. But so I don't think that a decline is here to stay. I think that I hope that what we're seeing right now is a kind of a challenge towards us where we hopefully can realize that our direction is lost. We've been unfortunately manipulated by forces that do not want to see our continuation and our greatness, if you will. And I think that a rebirth of our civilization actually is possible if we can step up to the challenge and realize that what we have at our disposal is still very much something that's going to be beneficial. And with new technology, with all the things we see in the world, I don't know, we might be in a very different, you know, scenario here in 20, 30, maybe 40 years down the line. And hopefully it's something that we've, you know, gotten wiser to, and who knows where we can go with technology, right? I mean, Western man has been an explorer. We have been, you know, challenging the boundaries all the time. You know, maybe it's time to go out and really look into space travel and possible other colonization. I mean, who knows where we will go with all this? Wait, is your view generally positive, Ricardo, though?
I can say it depends on the day, and it depends on what our time span I'm thinking about. I tend to think in more in, I don't know how should I express this. I mean, on the one hand, the situation has been made very difficult by this immigration situation. If you look at England, if you look at France, I don't know how one can envision a peaceful solution, a peaceful way out of the situation they're right now in.
Yeah.
I mean, I can see Muslims in France really asserting themselves, demanding at least some territorial control, the French granting that, and France kind of decreasing in size, decreasing in strength. But then I also see the French asserting themselves, and as they do that, tensions rise, things get even worse. There's a lot of bloodshed and so on. The same thing I see possibly happening in England. And then in places like Canada, I see a situation in which it will just keep going and going until our major cities are heavily Asian, and there doesn't seem to be a way out of it. I do believe that it is very difficult to talk of Canada as a Western culture once its cities are majority non-European. And so in a situation like that, I get pessimistic. And at the same time, I don't see necessarily future violence. The society may just linger along that way, and it may just be a more mixed society that just marches on and goes on like that. So I see that happening in Australia. Clearly it's the case in the United States already. I don't know how the United States can truly assert its identity. You have separate states where whites go into those states and really make sure that they stay majority white. But I mean, California, Texas, New York, and all those states, I don't know how one can envision an optimistic future in which the Western identity is preserved and advanced.
Yeah, I see what you're saying. I mean, because a country is the people, it's not the geographical circumference that's drawn up on a map. People are talking about, you know, potential secession and everything else, that there might be a breakup of into smaller, you know, regions and territory. Because, I mean, to be honest, I don't see how the intense polarization that is occurring now on the political spectrum is going to make things, you know, even easier. Because even if it's not violence between the religious factions or, let's say, ethnic factions, then I think it's possible that we might see it between the political factions, even if they happen to be the same ethnicity. It's kind of a repeat what we saw in Germany, you know, with the intense strife between the communists and the fascists, right? It gets so politically polarized that these people is going to have a difficult time living next to each other, even to that extent. I mean, I don't see how a country with 350 million people can be run in such a way that it appeases everybody. I mean, I think this idea of the failure of democracy is very pertinent here, that we have to rethink the whole societal shape and form, and this idea of a few people judging for you know, the masses of how they should live. It's just, it doesn't work anymore. It's an old, dying political way of thinking, and I think we need something completely new that is much more, you know, palatable to everybody in the way they want to live and with whom and what kind of political and economic system. I don't know. I see breakup to a certain extent and into smaller territories and regions where there is greater choice, Ricardo, than it is today.
Yeah, in the United States, I see that already happening. People will not vocally express opposition to integration and immigration, but they express it by the choices they make in terms of where they buy their homes, where they send their kids to school, and even the kind of states they're choosing to live in. So I see that trend in the United States, a trend whereby there is a silent protest, if you like, by the choice of the places you live. And at the same time, I see the liberals getting more hysterical in promoting their agenda, in trying to coerce everyone to buy into integration, into diversity, and pushing it ever more in the media, and really managing to brainwash and persuade millions of young people who don't know any better and think that's just the way to go. I mean, the young generation watching mosh music and videos where racial integration and mixing is rampant, is pervasive. It's like the ultimate best idea that people have come up with. And they're selling this in sports, in football. And so that trend is going to coexist with a trend whereby more conservative-oriented whites, even liberals themselves, who are hypocrites, will be separating themselves in terms of cohabitation and so on. So, yeah, there are many trends going on like that. And it could be that white nationalism, if you like, will appear later on to the conservatives who are not at this point willing to use the word white. In due time, it will appeal to them. If the black integration problem is not solved and gets worse and worse, I don't see how they're going to keep voicing this idea that integration is good for everyone. So there are many trends. Another thing too is that one of the things I come to realize, even though in many ways I know by temperament I tend to be a liberal, I do have come to understand all conservatives better, and that however much these all conservative values may seem to be against one's choices and may require one to do things you don't want to do, they're the things that sustain a people. I mean, you look at the Amish, they're not into technology. They look like weak and odd and out of place, but they have one thing going for them, and that is that they have large families and they keep reproducing.
Yeah.
The same thing with the Mormons. The Mormons, their fertility rate is not as high as that of the Amish, but it's still higher than the average Canadian fertility rate. They have cohesive families. And in Utah, they have kept growing and growing. So people who have conservative values in the old sense, patriarchy, big families, they go to church, they have something that they really believe in and that guides them day to day. This may be the way to go, or the way in which quite a few people will go. And I can see how all conservative values may well reassert themselves. The Europeans are really like very, very liberal, but in America, I do see more of these all conservative people. But in Europe, perhaps through the new right, this conservatism may come in slightly different forms and lead to some kind of revival.
Well, I think that the demographics question is something that has to change. And I mean, there's a number of interesting aspects that kind of pop up when we begin to examine both the idea of immigration, but also this idea of it's almost like we might see the rise of we already do, but population wars and demographic wars. That there's, you know, there's one aspect of this is the more you bring in, for example, in the United States, there's a lot of talk about you know, inequality and making things fair and the differences between the economic situations and everything else. But the fact is what they're doing in America and other countries as well is we're importing poverty with mass immigration. It further kind of creates these rifts between the different classes, if you will, if you want to use that term, in terms of what they're saying that they're claiming to fight. The same thing could be said, for example, of the question of overpopulation, that there is this kind of, you know, obsession there among the environmentalists in terms of the populations and everything else. But at the same time, then I think you guys had an article there on the website that showed the differences between the natural expansion of the population in America versus what it is today when mass immigration is taken into account. And it was like, you know, half the 100 million or something, even more has added on to it. So there's a number of kind of points that they're trying to solve politically. That of course is a contradiction in terms of the immigration question as well, Ricardo. So there's a lot of weird things that doesn't make sense in terms of how they're trying to run things politically, if we put it that way.
Yeah, a lot of things don't make sense where you're trying to always find a politically correct answer to difficulties. Take for example the current increase in number of African migrants or boat people trying to get into Europe. First, they come into some islands in the Mediterranean, and from there they jump into Spain or into Italy, and they don't know what to do with this issue. And my view is that long ago, they should have made the decision to sink a few of these boats. And yes, you're going to kill some people, but you send a clear message that this is not a way to deal with the difficulties of Africa is facing, and that Spain and Italy are not about to commit suicide because they don't have the nerve to just sink a few boats. This would have been just a normal, easy practice in Roman times or any time just a few decades ago.
Right.
So people in European nations are going to have to come to terms with some tough decisions like that. But I don't see any signs that they will at this point in time. In this respect, the ideology of human rights is like they have their backs against the wall and they make all sort of ridiculous arguments because you may be respecting the human rights of the boat people, but at the same time, in bringing many Africans into neighborhoods where they're not wanted and nobody voted for it, you're violating the rights of the people in those neighborhoods, in schools where the curriculum has to be changed and so on and so forth.
And just to pick up on that quickly there, and remember where you were, I want to hear the rest of that, but even the idea that if Europe sends this message that, oh, it's okay, come on over, you could even argue that, okay, these boats actually do sink on their own. There's been a lot of accidents of this. And this is now then encouraging that continued behavior and actually in the extension risking more lives than actually is necessary. It might sound weird and as a contradiction in itself, but I think that if there is no clear message and line along this type of thinking, I think that there is the level of the self-sacrifice where this idea that, you know, Europe belongs to everybody, and we're completely even going to sacrifice our own well-being. Is a long-term dangerous strategy. It's something that also prevents, for example, a lot of people that are well-educated, let's say, in other parts of the world that don't want to live in the conditions where they currently are at. They choose to uproot. They choose to go to Europe or America or Canada or Australia or whatever you have, you know. And in that process, the country that they fled from are losing the quality of those people that they would need to improve the conditions where they are at. So it's actually, in the long term, again, might sound weird, but in the long term, it's actually a way of continuing to keeping the third world country or second world country in a kind of a disparity, and actually preventing them from actually making the decisions locally and saying, we need to change things here. We can't just drag our problems with us, right?
Yeah, I mean, it is amazing when I read Charles Taylor and Yugo Habermas making arguments in the name of human rights to the effect that we cannot send back. I mean, you could say in the case of refugees, but even in the case of economic migrants, they say that, well, you know, Habermas says Europeans migrated into North America. So now why should they be restricting economic migrants from the rest of the world? They're just seeking a better life. But they don't follow through this argument. They don't consider the fact that the policies that are consciously implemented in Canada, which I know better, are to the effect that we want to bring the best talent from Africa and from South America here. We want their potential nurses and doctors and engineers. And to me, this is a way of stealing their talent for our own purposes. And yeah. Nobody really talks about this. And I think, you know, there's a lot of this way of thinking among the current elites. On the one hand, they want to adorn themselves with a lot of moral, should I say, flowers to embellish their characters by making easy arguments. When in truth, throughout history, people always made arguments which entail sacrifice for others, or entail decisions that were not going to be beneficial to others, because you were thinking of some greater good and you were thinking of your own people. They don't think that. They have this universal illusion that you can make a decision that somehow is going to benefit everyone. But yeah. Again, it doesn't benefit everyone. It makes everything worse. So, but in the end, this is more than an argument, because as I was saying before, it may well be that people today, in terms of their own character and psychological makeup, just don't have it to make these kinds of arguments. When I say to people, I've said this before, that those African boats, they should be just sunk, a few of them, they just really say, oh my God, you really are like a cruel and this and that. And they just sitting there in their comfortable homes without having to make any decisions. And so, you know, I try to tell them that these are decisions that I'm not making for myself. I could just adorn myself with morally righteous views that in the long run are going to be harmful for everyone. But their character is such that they cannot make these kinds of, not even decisions. They cannot even have these thoughts in their heads. So nobody says them. And I don't know how is that going to be overcome. So I do think there is a deep-seated element here that is beyond arguments, despite the fact that I try to argue in my blog and elsewhere. It is beyond argument and may have to do with the current psychological makeup of the population and their inability to conceive of violence, of hardship, and just asserting themselves in a strong way against others.
Well, again, making those tough decisions and facing them in the now is something that I believe our ancestors were accustomed to making. Those it's a kind of a tough love, really, when you look at it. And it's the same treatment in nature. It might not be easy to see, you know, something eaten or attacked in nature, whatnot, but the fact is that if we would run around and save every animal that we see from being eaten in you know, we would be inundated with an imbalance in nature. And the fact is, we think that we're removed from this. And I think that yeah. It is an exhibit of a kind of a mental weakness. And my point is, it might feel good in the short term, but this is something that ultimately is going to catch up with us. And it's something that's going to hurt a heck of a lot more in the long term, in the bigger picture, when we're going to be faced with issues and problems that are so difficult and so monumental, instead of taking those small step difficult decisions right now. So I'm thinking long term, and I see that all of this that's happening right now is not only to the detriment of Europeans or Westerners, it's for everybody globally, actually, that we have to assert some kind of body of rule, and there has to be some tough love in this situation to ask everyone to step up to the plate, to ask everyone to try to achieve harder as opposed to flee from the area where you are because it's, you know, uncomfortable at the moment. I don't know.
Yeah, before you brought the environmentalists, who this is something that I learned recently because I haven't been really involved with the environmentalist movement and their writings. But one of the things that struck me from writing this article with Tim Murray is that not long ago, and it was a cardinal principle of the environmentalist movement, that the biggest cause of environmental deterioration was population growth. And then quite early, already in the 1970s, there were some environmentalists in California who said, well, guess what? The biggest cause of population growth in California is immigration.
Yeah.
And so they connected those two, and then they came to the conclusion, if you're going to be making serious, tough decisions as to what needs to be done to protect the environment, you're going to have to limit immigration. So they became immigration restrictionists. And people don't know this today, but up until the early 1990s, immigration restrictionists were very influential in the environmentalist movement in the United States. But then the cultural Marxist system began to turn against them and gradually managed to persuade some of the leaders in the environmentalist movement that they should not be against immigrants, that they were anti-immigrant, and so on. So this idea that if you say population growth has to be limited, and the way to do that is to limit immigration, it could not be voiced. And I have been in a bit of interaction with a few environmentalists through the email, and they have said, yes, I mean, I used to be leftist guy, I'm all for flower, future, get along, live in harmony with the environment, love humanity. But I really had to face up to the fact that immigration was the biggest cause of pollution because of urban sprawl and real estate development and so on.
Yeah.
And when I did that, I was called all kinds of names, and I was really driven out of the environmentalist movement. So now the environmentalist movement is led by easygoing, well-off liberals who don't make that connection at all. And I brought this to attention to some professors nearby who was making or sending an email to the effect that we need to sign this to protect the environment against the big, greedy corporations. And I said, well, if you don't make the connection to immigration, I think that what you're doing is pure moral posturing. And then I sent some links about arguments that were made about immigration. And he just said, whatever, that was the answer. He didn't even want to deal with it. He just brushed it off. So this is something that people may want to know, because there are some people on the, who are critics of the left, and they don't realize that there are leftists out there in the environmentalist movement who came to that decision as well about immigration, but they were suppressed. And we might sort of recollect that. And we can be for immigration. I mean, we can be for the environment, and not dismiss, because the global warming thing was exaggerated, and the leftists began to side with the corporations and try and plan more centralized control over people's behavior. So we can sort of be skeptical about that. But you can still use the environmentalist argument in your efforts to limit immigration.
Yeah, it's interesting. I think the environmental movement and everything else, it's always about conservation in the environment and conserving everything and keeping, maintaining that there's no change in anything in any regard. But again, something they do not apply to the human world. It's everything except, for example, conserving European heritage and culture. It's like we're like a blank sheet that you just can kind of impose other, quote, richer, unquote, cultures upon, and we have to kind of just stand back in amazement of everyone else and end with our own appreciation for what we've done and contributed to the world. And I think that, frankly, that's a racist ideology, if anything, you know?
Oh, yeah, there is no question. There is a real dislike. It's paradoxical, is that dislike of the fact of how you Europeans dare to have achieved so much. Who do you think you are to say that you introduced modern science, that most of the innovations came from you, that the Renaissance came from you, that the Greek created philosophy, that Elizabethan England was an incredible place of place and deep understandings about human psychology through the writings of Shakespeare, and that you have one writer after another, novelist who's so new and uses language in such a masterful way, that all the classical composers came from Europe, your painting, your architecture. How dare you? We're going to put you in your place and show you that you're not that good. In fact, you may well be one of the worst people on this planet. I mean, this is, this is the kind of insanity that I have to deal with in the university. I'm wow. walking there, and I'm supposed to be dealing with higher learning, and people are doing the reverse. They're trying to overturn, to besmirch, is that the word? To degrade the achievements of Europeans, or not to talk about them at all, and concentrate on the slave trade and that kind of thing. So one of the things I do, and I take pleasure in, and I think I said this in the first interview, is that I take pleasure in affirming European achievements, reminding them of it. And this is important because in my blog, I'm not particularly interested in putting down other ethnic groups, because I can understand that it is human nature for them to have pride, and they should.
Of course, they should. That's the point. Yeah, everyone should. Yeah,
own history and so forth. But I think we need to first have an accurate, as far as we can, understanding of the actual history of Europeans. And if modern science came out of Europe, then that has to be understood. And also, it is part of this revival, this recovery, I think, to affirm European ethnic identity and history, rather than engaging in ongoing negative criticisms of other ethnic groups, which I think are not fruitful.
Yeah, I agree with that. I don't have any interest. I think that, again, if we mentioned this many times on the program, but the wonders of the diversity, the true diversity that exists within mankind, it's something that is worth preserving. And in that way, I am a conservationist. I want to protect that to a certain extent and conserve that. But I'm seeing this huge, immense double standard where any other culture except the European cultures is valued above that to no extent. And I'm frankly sick of the double standards here. And I guess as well, an additional problem within this has to do with the cultural relativism to a certain extent, this idea also that everyone is the same. And I think that this is something that goes against the Western traditions that we've had in the past, Ricardo, of a kind of a recognition of, let's say, a natural aristocracy, that the heroic deeds of a few individuals are those who became, kings. And I think that this is another realization that we have to face in the West, that neither we or nature is egalitarian, and that egalitarianism actually is a revolt against nature. And if we don't realize that and accept that, and again, it doesn't mean that there aren't things that others are good at or anything like that. It just means recognizing the differences between us. That could be applied to the individuals, or it could be applied to the different, races or ethnicities, what have you. But I think when that is realized, that we truly kind of adapt or adopt, we will become, it will become more clear of who we are and what our purpose is, and even our way of collaborating together and actually achieving some good stuff on this planet. We're going to be well off when we come to that realization. That is my point, anyway.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think that because one rejects egalitarianism that you have to accept the corporate argument that if you lose out in the marketplace, too bad for you, you can just be brushed to the side. In the past, societies like medieval Europe had an organic conception in which it was clearly understood that the farming peoples were essential to the maintenance of society and to the sustenance of the church and the aristocracy. So they value the role of the farming peoples. And this is one of the reasons why Aquinas and other philosophers at the time, they came up with the concept of a just price. And what they meant by it, they didn't want to have a society in which a few merchants exploit the market in such a way that they buy cheap or inexpensive in one place and then try and sell very expensive in another place, or they try and get peasants, farmers into debt and then buy out their lands and that kind of thing.
Yeah.
So they felt that you had to have a price that could sustain the organic unity of the society. But I think this is possible, and this is another reason for ethnic cohesion. And even some leftists have come to this realization because they sincerely believe in egalitarianism. So they say, well, look, if we're going to have a true cohesive society, you cannot have different ethnic groups in such a way that one ethnic group is directing its resources and its money to another ethnic group, and that creates a lot of tension in that society. So you have to have ethnic cohesion so that when you direct your resources to the lower levels of society, at least you have something in common with them in terms of heritage and religion and so on. So even the Middle Ages, then, even though they were far poorer and have less means, they did have that, and people don't appreciate that. There were some leftists that did understand this, some leftist writers. I forget his name now. He wrote a book on the Protestant ethic and the rise of capitalism. I think that more or less it's not Max Weber, it's another English historian who then applied it to England. And he made this observation of how capitalism disrupted this organic unity, and this unity did exist in various places in medieval Europe. So yeah, I mean, even though my book is very much for the aristocratic character of European society, that doesn't mean that I am for a global elite that has no loyalty to any nation and just thinks of itself and makes money in complete disregard of your own people and your own ancestors. I think that our side, in many ways, ultimately, even as we emphasize aristocracy, we respect and understand the value of the other segments of society.
Well, exactly. This is a interesting quirk, because here's really where Marxist internationalism and international financiers kind of agree. World hegemony and world monopoly, and of course, whatever system they have dictating that at the end, that'll be their choice. But they agree on the fact that they're trying to eradicate all the kind of the differences between us. And I think it's fairly obvious as well, Ricardo, that they are trying to their best achievement to kind of create a world culture right now, a monoculture where everything is the same. And I think that in their view, this is perhaps a long-term plan, and maybe they even recognize and realize that, yes, we'll have to sacrifice a few generations. They'll be, you know, warring with each other. There will be blood in the streets, and, you know, there will be conflicts on a religious basis and ethnic basis. But at the end of it, it's going to be good, because it's going to create this kind of, you know, peaceful world where everyone is the same and looks the same and everything else. But do you think that this is something that they'll be able to actually pull? Because my point here is that if we take away culture and heredity and recognition of ancestry and that type of identification, I think that you create a tremendously weakened human being. And if that is the foundation that they want to build a new kind of a world order on, I think that they've misjudged the situation, and they haven't realized that this is a weakened fundament, basically, and it's going to cause this structure that they're trying to build to fall fairly quickly. I think it might not even go into place. I think that a response to what we're seeing right now with globalism and everything else is actually that people are going to go back to the roots. They're really going to start looking at who they are, where they come from, who their ancestors were, what their culture was in the area that they're living in. And this is actually going to reawaken something which is going to be very, very positive at the end of it. How do you view this, Ricardo?
Well, I think that there are many in the left that truly believe that the biggest problem that creates conflict in the world is racial difference, ethnic conflict, and that the way to avoid those conflicts, potential conflicts, is to mix everyone and create a more integrated, equal society. In the case of the United States, I also think that many in the left really believe that whites are still racist, that the reason blacks are unable to rise to the same level as whites in education and economically is because they're discriminated against. So they're going to keep pressing for racial integration and mixing and so on. So they think this is some sort of solution. Then there are those on the right that have come to accept this kind of leftist argument and also to see it as a way for them to create corporations that appeal to the globe, so that if you're selling a product and you want to get into the Indian market, the Chinese market, and the ethnic market in your country, you are best to promote diversity. Like I have this subheading, one of the articles that was published, this one by Claire Ellis, in which it says leverage diversity to be more successful. And as I was Googling this particular image that I wanted to use for the article by Claire Ellis, because I saw that her article really brings out what this image is saying, this is one corporation after another who is now using this kind of pro-diversity, pro-cultural Marxist image and way of thinking, because they think it is successful. It is a way to maintain a company that meets the attention of the global market. So yeah, the left and the right have converged together. They don't make the exact same arguments. They bicker about the distribution of income and taxes and so on, but they have converged together on this crucial issue for different reasons, as I just indicated. But I, as you were just pointing out, I do see in Europe, more so in Europe, because we were talking earlier about these political parties that are rising and want restricted immigration, in which they're recognizing that they do have a history, they do want to keep their identity, and they don't want to give in to this kind of diversity program. Canada, I don't see that at all. It may well be. Sometimes I think that Canada has been used as the model to how everybody in the world should be in the future,
yeah.
And that it sells well because we don't have racial tensions that are evident in the sense that you see clear-cut violent cases to a high degree. So it is being sold that way to the world. So yeah.
What about the reawakening of the European identity within the Canadians, though? How about that? Of looking back, well, where did you come from?
Yeah, that's what I would like. That is my objective. But as I was trying to form this so-called council and this blog, I was emailing people that I knew were concerned with immigration. I had obtained their emails, and some of them were conservative. Mostly, I would say they were conservative. They didn't like political correctness. But really, the majority of them were very skeptical, very even fearful about getting into ethnicity. They saw this is something that should be avoided. I should only talk about Canadian values. And I wasn't going to back down in that respect, because I think to employ the idea of Canadian values is a loose situation. Our values have been changed. Diversity and multiculturalism are now spread through every institution and school, and it is difficult to say that they're not part of our values. Secondly, it assumes that any ethnic group can assimilate those values, and therefore you're stuck with having to argue against immigration, because if you can show that immigrants can assimilate and have assimilated to basic values, because these values are very basic and general. They just means rule, you accept rule of the law, you're gonna get a job, you're not gonna be violent, you're gonna go to school, and you're gonna be democratic. So, which are not really particularly Canadian, but if that's all you have for Canada, you really don't have a good argument against immigration. So I thought that you had to emphasize European ethnicity in Canada. And that's what I'm hoping to do. One of the things I intend to do in a future article is I really want to argue against the notion that Canada is an immigrant nation. I don't think that history shows that. I think that Canada is first and foremost a European nation created by Europeans. So the concept immigrant is not a first concept to use. The first concept is European. And then you can say European immigrant. It's a nation created by European immigrants, if you want to put it that way, but not by immigrants without any ethnicity.
Now, we're going to wrap things up here in a little bit, but maybe I'll ask you if you want to tackle that or not in terms of the we've talked about it now in many programs in the past, and the idea of the spirit that existed among all people throughout history in terms of, you know, conquest and taking land and resources and fighting with each other, and the way that we've try to explain to people as well that, for example, on the American continent, there were tremendous infighting between tons of different tribes and whatnot. But as soon as the Europeans showed up on the continent and took part in the same type of behavior, now they are treated differently and are somehow viewed upon as tremendous demons or whatnot. Has the situation been very much the same in Canada in regards to that? And I'm not trying to defend all practices or everything like that has been going on either. It's not about there, but it's about the fact that there was a different mindset if we go back a few hundred years than it is today, and we make the mistake of thinking that they were thinking like we do today, and we can't judge them with the same moral compass now that we that they had then, you know. So is this something that you get into in your work as well, of trying to, I guess, defending the idea that the Canada that we know today is, you know, it was created by Europeans and for Europeans, and that's just the way it is. No matter how much we wish that it wasn't so, it's not gonna magically revert the situation, you know.
Yes, I mean, I was thinking, I think this often, that many of the academics that one sees today at our universities really have a almost, and this may be too good a term to use for them, a childlike mind. But then I sometimes think children even have a more instinctive understanding of conflict and competition than they do. So that may be too good a term to use for them, but it's a form of infantile thinking whereby they think that you can possibly create a nation with a state of mind that they're trying to nurture and cultivate, which is impossible. So they have to get past that. Here, Canadians have to get past this idea that you could possibly have created a Canadian nation with the mindset that we have today. That would never have transpired. And the settlers that came in here would have not survived at all. They would have been liquidated. So once they understand that and they understand the struggle for existence, they can understand better why it is that you cannot be talking about the creation of Canada as if it were some crime, as if it could possibly have been done without a crime as they defined it. So it will take time, but I do think that when you tell people this, when you talk to an audience, to students, and you say it sort of in the same way that I'm trying to say it now, they understand it because this is common sense. People, no one then in the past had the kind of securities, welfare supports that immigrants have today. So even though it goes against the grain to present Canada as a nation created by Europeans and that we should do so without any guilt. It makes sense. It really will resonate with individuals. And I think it is part of human nature to have a sense of pride. Children are drawn to heroes. They're drawn to those that even win. That doesn't mean they don't care about those that don't. People can have a complex understanding of what may be the reasons. In the case of the natives, I don't see them as losers because they fought in a manly fashion. They should be celebrated that way, not as victims just asking for welfare today and just whining about what happened in the past, but as people who put a fight as was normal and those days.
Yep.
They saw with manly courage, and they happen to have been overwhelmed by the Europeans. But then, even then, that term overwhelm is not accurate because there was a lot of coexistence, give and take, benefits here and there. And it just so happens that the Europeans eventually outnumbered them, and their civilization, our values, ways of life were far more dynamic. And so a modern society was created. But I mean, I am for a native national self-determination within Canada in the same way that the Quebecois have some degree of national determination within Quebec. I raised this issue in the article on Charles Taylor. What I'm against is the notion of immigrant cultural collective rights within Canada, if only because I first would like to restrict immigration quite a lot, in fact, a whole moratorium on it. But it's right.
Oh, definitely. No, I see what you're saying, Ricardo. I think that another double standard here is if people can look back in history and be against, you know, the type of activity that they claim to be against, the type of conquest, then, if you will, then they should be opposed to what's happening right now, because it's the same thing, but just in a different manner. And it's more of a long-term plan with replacement level migration. It's the same type of conquest. So if you're for one, you can't be, you know, against the other, and vice versa. It's like it goes both ways there. And I think that this infantile thinking that you mentioned before as well is a really good point, because with their line of thinking that we're seeing out of the academic world and the political correctness of the politicians and everything else, the question people have to ask themselves with that, are we seeing the preservation of the land and the territory and the nation? No, we're actually seeing the loss of it. I mean, in the U.S., the south of the border, a lot of Mexicans, they see this as taking back the land. Similarly, I've heard sentiments from a lot of Muslims who see that they can actually gain territory now in Europe. This is a way of achieving, you know, religious fulfillment of holding and claiming this land for Allah, you know, and they are seeing that we're letting our guard down. We're completely just backing down. They're recognizing that
the left doesn't see that. It's amazing. I mean,
yeah,
they really have no understanding of human nature. They're really naive, just so ignorant in terms of understanding what has happened in history. For them to think that you're going to have millions and millions of Mexicans arriving in the United States into lands which they believe were theirs in the past, and then you're going to have a multicultural, pro-diversity education welcoming them, and then that's not going to encourage them to even claim that land even more so. It's just ridiculous. But this is how they think. I mean, in the case of Muslims in Europe, I have discussions not long ago with an academic from a nearby university in which he just could not believe that I was even saying that Muslims are kind of really asserting themselves in France and England. He said, oh, that's just Islamophobia.
Right.
I met a Muslim the other day in a conference, and he sounded like a really pleasant person. You're just stereotyping all Muslims. And they just meet some Muslim that they hang around in a restaurant for a little bit, who tells them what they want to hear. And they really love all this diversity talk from the whites. And they kind of say, yeah, I agree with everything you're saying, because it means they're going to, you know, they're being handed over. They're saying, oh, yeah, English people, just hand me over your land. I'm in agreement with you. We're good people. We don't mean any harm. So it's just like, really, you're talking to children, really, in the end. Like, you just, they're just.
Yeah. I mean, they don't understand human nature, and that these drives to take and hold land and claim territory and property and everything else is something that magically has gone away since the 1960s because of a couple of political ideas. I mean, this is so unbelievably naive, and there is even an extension to this, as you said, and that there is a kind of a, from the Muslim community, not everybody, I'm not trying to put everyone over the same, you know, in the same bracket here, but there is a resentment for Europe and Europeans and the way of our lifestyles and everything else, and in this process they see it as a betterment. It's actually a divine task from their point of view to take over and change us and give this land over to Allah and hold it and claim it. And I think that they're not realizing that, again, as we've said throughout this program now, that there is conflict at the heart of this, and they are still standing around despite at some point there are going to be people have them backed up against the wall with a knife in their hand, and they're going to say, howdy friend, you know, how's it going today, when they literally are seeking your eradication. And not everyone thinks like that, I recognize that, but within some of the cultural and religious, you know, ideologies that we're seeing, this is part of it. And if we're not recognizing that and realizing that we are now just handing over the territory, they are nonetheless, whatever the situation is, going to take advantage of that. They're going to say, thank you very much, it's now ours, back out of the way. And we're going to have lost what our ancestors fought for and kept in our name. And I think it's ultimately an insult to our ancestors to treat them in such a way that we do, in the fact of us looking down on them and everything else.
The thing is, you don't have to have every Muslim think that way. History is made by elites. And yes, if the elites think that way and articulate those ideas, they're the ones who will bring about what they want to bring about. And you look at the French Revolution, it was made by a small minority of Frenchmen. It wasn't an all-out revolution led by the majority of Frenchmen. We have this idea that somehow, because we live in a so-called democratic society, that you need a majority vote on the part of this ethnic group or that ethnic group to claim that they are a certain way, but you don't. You just need to know what their elites are thinking. The people who actually are engaged in politics understand politics. And there's no question that they are very strong, dynamic and active members of the Muslim elite that do think in terms of civilizational takeover and civilizational conflict. The same goes with Mexicans, and the same goes with the topic of Black violence in the United States. There is no question that the majority of Blacks in the United States are not violent, but when you look at this issue statistically and you approach it that way, the violence of Blacks, either between themselves, but now increasingly against whites, has a high statistical importance, because it is disproportionate to their numbers. And because when you have a majority Black population in an area of the United States, then even though they say in Detroit, I don't know right now what is the proportion of Blacks in Detroit, but even though the majority of Blacks within that majority Black population in Detroit is not violent, the fact that they are the majority population and that they are disproportionately the more violent ones, then this does have an incredible statistical effect on the conditions in Detroit, to the point that we know you cannot walk into many areas past a certain time. This is now taking as natural and as given, but this is true in Chicago, it's true in Washington, D.C., and Atlantic City. So you don't need to say that the majority of them are this way. You only simply need to show that it has a statistical importance, and that elites are the ones that make history, and that the masses are called the masses because they tend to be shaped by the elites.
Very good. All right, Ricardo, thank you for a very interesting discussion, thought-provoking research, of course, as usual. I think it's very important to discuss this territory that so many unfortunately refuse and shy away from. It's just important that we openly can discuss this and realize what is going on with the elite and the way they are attacking Western civilization and everything else. Let me mention the book again here, The Uniqueness of Western Civilization, and an excellent book, a defense of the West and European identity as well, something that's been, as we've said now, under ferocious attack since the 1960s, primarily from the cultural Marxists, but also from the politicians. Please let us know if there's anything additional, Ricardo, you'd like to give out, if you have something upcoming, or give us the website, and I hope we can talk more again soon. It's always good to have you on, Ricardo.
Well, just to the audience, look out for articles in the website. I'm going to be addressing these issues. And I also like to thank Red Eyes Radio. I think that what you guys are doing there is really great, and you're addressing now the bigger issues of our times. I can see it more and more in the links that you have at your website and the interviews that you're doing. So I think you need to be praised for that greatly, and that people should keep going to Red Eyes.
Thank you so much, Ricardo. Really appreciate that. Yeah, there's... We need to stand up for Western civilization. It is unique, and it is worth preserving. We have to do that. It's a major task that we have ahead of us. But I'm positive. I think we'll find new creative aspirations as we are challenged by some of these difficulties as we move forward. So I'm really positive at the end of it. But all right, again, eurocanadian.ca is the website. Go there, check it out. We'll have that linked up from our websites as well. Thank you so much, Ricardo. Really appreciate it.
Okay, thanks, Henrik.
Well, we have some excellent programs coming, dear friends, that you do not want to miss. John Lash is returning for a two-part program. Very important. We also have Max Egan, Gary Biltcliff, and many others. Thank you for listening, for being a member, for your support, keeping us going. Also, my thanks to the Red Eyes crew. Please take care and stay healthy. All of you, ladies and gentlemen, keep your mind and body in shape, improve, and shine like a bright light, and we'll speak more soon.